Hello, and thank you for tuning in to this episode of the M2.0 series of AMPUL, the Australian Medical Students Association podcast. My name is Liz, and I'll be your host for today's episode with special guest, Dr. Renee Lim. Renee is an incredible woman who wears a number of hats. She's a doctor, an educator, a performer. She works as a health grant advisor, a senior lecturer in professional development, and is the CEO of a social enterprise, The Changeneers. As well as this, she works as a doctor in emergency, palliative and aged care and has a number of experience in performing arts, as well as an actress, a writer and director. In this episode, Renee was kind enough to sit down with me and discuss a project she was recently involved in called Grace Under Pressure. This project is a verbatim piece which explores the juxtaposition that is the expectations put on healthcare workers versus the reality of the day-to-day experience and how this impacts on the culture of our workplaces, as well as the mental health of us that work within these. Renee shared an incredibly honest account with me of her own experiences in mental health and mental illness, as well as how she faced the experience of miscarrying her child while mourning the death of her partner. She provides us with some incredible tips on how we can work not only on our own mental health, but how we can approach and support each other to improve the culture of medicine and in turn the mental health of not only ourselves but our peers. I do want to point out that this episode discusses some potentially distressing topics, including miscarriage, bereavement, and suicide attempts. If any of these topics cause you distress, please still consider listening up until 27 and a half minutes, from 46 to 58 minutes, as well as from an hour, as Renee provides some really valuable information regarding her experience of being reported to APRA, as well as her advice on how to approach our peers and improve our culture around mental health in medicine. If this episode causes you distress, please feel free to contact Lifeline on 131114. I got a lot from this conversation with Renee, and I hope you do too. Before going any further, I would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which we reside here, in what is known as Australia, the place of recording. I extend my respects to elders of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, past, present, and emerging. AMSA acknowledges that the sovereignty of this land has never been ceded, and this land always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
I'm only human, can you see? I made a mistake. Please just look me in my face. Tell me everything's okay. Cause I got it. Ooh, never be like you.
Everyone for joining us today. I have the very, very lovely Dr. Renee Lim on the line with me to have a chat. Thank you so much for joining me today, Renee.
You're very welcome, Liz. I'm very excited to be here.
Thank you. So to get us started, would you mind telling us who you are?
Oh gosh, who am I? We've had this conversation, I believe, already. So I find it very hard to summarize myself into a few words, but my name is Renee Lim. I am a medical doctor. I work as a locum in Jerry's, Palcare and emergency until quite recently, and happen to have a few other prongs. So I'm the ultimate slashy, I think is how most people describe me. I am also the CEO of an EdTech social enterprise. I teach communication skills across the healthcare sector. I'm an actor and presenter and I suppose filmmaker. I do a lot of work in the not-for-profit sector in a couple of different organizations, sort of supporting social enterprise and the social sector in general. So how to improve how society engages with each other.
So one of the many, many roles that you're involved in has turned into a passion project for yourself recently, Grace Under Pressure. An amazing play which discusses the incredible juxtaposition of the expectations put upon healthcare professionals with the reality of the day-to-day experiences.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us about Grace Under Pressure and how this play became a project for you?
So if we go back to the beginning, so Grace Under Pressure actually started as a research project under the Sydney Arts and Health Collective, which was a Sydney University group of both medical professionals as well as drama and arts professionals. I wasn't involved in that original iteration, and they were very interested in looking at the potential power of drama and the arts in terms of improving health culture.
Mm.
So they actually organized and got funding, which is always very rare in research to get funding in anything that isn't like, you know, creating a drug.
Yeah, absolutely. So,
you know, kudos to them. But they got funding to actually run a series of interviews. They found a number of different people across the sector, nurses and doctors who had been involved in health either right now, so interns and junior doctors and medical students, all the way through to people that had kind of gone through the process of being in the health sector and almost separated themselves from it as well.
Mm.
So a really diverse group of people. They interviewed all of them, they took the transcripts from all of them, and then they commissioned the amazing David Williams and Paul Dwyer to create what we call a verbatim theatre piece. So verbatim theatre is where you create a script, but it is the exact words, including the ums and the ahs and the pauses and the fumbles and all those things where if you ever looked at your language in transcript, you'd be like, oh my God, did I say that?
Yeah.
So we keep all of that because, you know, that's all part of how we actually hear ourselves and we hear others and we interpret those, all of those components of their conversations. Oh, wow. As part of their story. So this verbatim theatre piece was formed. And the Sydney Arts Health Collective were able to get it performed live at the Big Anxiety Festival at the Seymour Centre back in 2018. And I was lucky enough to have been brought on quite early on in the drafting process to be able to be one of the readers of one of the key roles. Mm. And after that drafting process, when they were taking it on stage, because I happened to be an actor as well, they actually invited me to be part of the professional cast to run the performance over a week. So that's kind of the original performance piece. And it's kind of really important to know that background. Mm. To understand what the history of the piece is, because while I was involved in it, one of the things that really stood out for me was in my other work I do in teaching communication skills and working with various different organizations to try to improve the experience of health for staff as well as for patients. It was the idea that in health, many people feel that their voices, A, are not heard, mm. but B, that people outside of the sector don't really understand. And that can be anything from, when I say outside the sector, obviously lay people or government or other organizations.
Mm.
But even within health, many people feel that, oh, I'm a doctor, you know, the allied health don't quite understand what my experience is, all the way through to, you know, the admin don't understand mm. what the clinical staff are doing. So there's this constant sense of people both not feeling hurt, but also thinking people don't know what I'm going through.
Mm.
So this play kind of was a really great opportunity because it brought together real voices and it actually allowed the safety for health professionals listening to this to go, actually, these are my voices. And so I don't have to question whether or not this is legitimate. I don't have to have that filter of going, ooh, are you doing a good job of representing me? Mm. Because actually I know that these are my colleagues. And that would allow potentially the space to be able to be sort of engaged with a lot faster.
Mm.
So people didn't have to go through that process first. And with that in mind, I spoke to the team and asked them whether they were happy for me to take it back to my organization, the Pam McLean Center, to commission a shorter version. So we got it down to just on an hour, which as we know is a grand rounds 1 hour, or it's a, you know, teaching session 1 hour,
mm.
which was much more doable in health. And then we piloted it across 4 different hospitals in Sydney. And fortunately, I have a lot of contacts in the area and was very, very lucky to be able to get some really senior people to come on board. And at the end of the year, so we were doing this close to Christmas time, you know, which is the worst time to try to get anything in the hospital.
Absolutely.
But these people were just, you know, really supportive. Some had seen the show and heard about it. And so they were willing to organize for us to get access to an auditorium. They invited all of their colleagues. You know, some shows were as small as 5 people because we didn't want to force anyone to mm. come. And the other, somewhere as big as 60. And that pilot showed us that the response to the show and the space that the show created to allow health professionals to talk about their experiences and work towards a group solution in a diverse group. So we had nurses, doctors, allied health, admin, all in the one room.
Yeah, wow.
Gave me the idea of approaching the Ministry of Health to get funding to actually offer this to the entire of New South Wales.
Mm.
And that was kind of the progression to which we got to Grace Under Pressure, the tour in 2019.
Yeah, wow. So how did that project then go in adapting from that smaller format to that statewide program?
So I wrote a brief. I wrote a very detailed document taking in some, I suppose, of my experience in consulting in the corporate sector around culture change and obviously all of the work that I was doing in health and knowing some of the issues that existed, and created a document that I then got managed to, you know, through some very, very lovely contacts who were very supportive again, into the Ministry of Health, into the senior culture team. They agreed to co-fund it as long as the LHDs got involved. I then sort of, I suppose, navigated conversations with various LHDs. And in the end, we had 7 different LHDs ranging from sort of Central Coast all the way down to southern New South Wales, out to the far west, Broken Hill Way.
Yeah, right.
And then the next step was to put together an actual tour. So we had to travel 4 actors, facilitators from Pam McLean to run a workshop, as well as the stage manager. So we had to travel these people around to 16 locations around the entire of New South Wales in a month. And the production company Alternative Facts came on board because they own the play and got that sorted.
Mm.
And then the separate part to that was then trying to individualize the experience. So for me, one of the key things in culture change and in supporting people to actively engage in becoming different, you have to personalize the experience and they have to own it. So myself and my colleague Joyce Stewart, we actually literally worked with each individual LHD to work out what they wanted us to talk about and to do as a workshop after the play. So every single location had a different program.
Wow. Just to clarify, sorry, what does the LHD stand for?
So local health districts. So when you guys think about hospitals,
right?
Basically every hospital is part of an LHD. The LHD is defined by a series of different suburbs. So in places like Sydney, for example, or Melbourne, the LHD may be quite a small space and there might be, say, 2 or 3 hospitals in it. When you go out to the rural areas, there are some areas that would probably cover thousands of kilometres and, again, only have 3 to 4 hospitals. But those kinds of locations are, you know, have their own issues because everyone's so disparate and so far apart.
How did you go about identifying those common issues within those different LHDs?
So we interviewed and spoke to the people who were our kind of contact people over there and gave them sort of a series of different ideas about what they might want to look into, how they might want to approach the workshop. But we basically handed it back to the people and culture teams at each of these locations. So one of the great things about how New South Wales Health has evolved in specifically is they are trying to improve culture in the workplace. So many of them have initiated what they call people and culture teams, or they may be a slightly different name. But the purpose of those staff is to find ways to improve communication within the organization, to evaluate and test kind of, you know, how things are working, and to try to improve the cultural experience for the staff, to improve their well-being, to improve, you know, their sense of kind of, I suppose, engagement.
In community.
New South Wales Health.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so a lot of those teams do exist now, which many people don't know about. So, you know, you guys obviously probably don't as students, but even a lot of junior doctors and even, some, you know, that they would be like, oh, those teams exist. But those are the people that try to develop the, you know, maybe sort of special days or events that are happening within the hospital. They organise a lot of training and teaching, you know, and things like that as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what that team is there to do. So we would work with each of those teams in each location, work out what is your location's main issue or main thing you'd like to work on, and then we would design a program specifically to their needs.
Right. And were there any interesting or common themes that came out of these programs between all the health services?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think so the way that we were trying to, I suppose, create the content, while it was quite specific in theory, the themes that came through were, they were ones that we were not surprised by. At no point did we have anyone bring up anything that we weren't like, oh yeah, totally, that's absolutely what would, you know, we had expected. At the same time, I think we were both surprised by and pleased by, I think, the fact that some of these themes didn't occur in places we thought they would, and unfortunately as well that they did occur in places where maybe we had hoped things would have improved. But, you know, they range from the physical environment and resources that people feel they do or don't have. They also talk a lot to the bullying and harassment environments and how do we improve that sense of safety in the workplace. there was a lot of talk around things like leadership and, I suppose, reward. So the idea that the culture we have in health doesn't really lend itself to focusing on positives.
Mm.
It tends to focus on things that have gone wrong.
Absolutely.
And one of the key changes that need to occur is that actually people kind of do need to start to think differently and to be able to reward positive outcomes.
Mm.
And also to be able to express when they think they've done something well. So there was this idea around supporting excellence or supporting positivity. And then some of the other things that came out were around feeling like they're not doing it alone. So how do we create better teamwork? How do we create better opportunities for training and education? How do we engage communities? So how do we work with people that aren't actually inside the hospital? Because there's so much opportunity in the community environments, not-for-profits, arts groups, aged care facilities. How do we start to connect with other organizations so we feel that we actually have a larger resource than we do?
Right. So encouraging that interdisciplinary engagement.
Yeah, I think there's definitely interdisciplinary is a part of it. I think it expands. I think if you think about what a hospital's job is, a hospital is there to provide the services to support the acute illness of an individual within that environment.
Mm.
But the reality would be is that that individual doesn't spend the majority of their time in that hospital.
Mm.
So once they're not in that hospital, unless they have a temporary acute trauma-based illness, most of them will require ongoing care. And the relationship that, you know, the hospital component has with the people outside of the hospital that are looking after that person every other day actually significantly impacts on that patient's outcome. So GPs, for example, but also other, you know, rehab services, aged care facilities who might be looking after a number of the older people day to day, not-for-profits that, you know, provide mental health support or might, you know, provide support to people with disability. All of those kinds of organizations actually provide a significant part of a service that we don't really tap into at the moment. So that's something that also needs to start to change.
Mm. Were there any tangible changes that you saw as an outcome of this program?
So it was obviously quite a large program. Mm. And in the end, if I check the numbers, so the reality would be that from doing 16 performances and workshops over 7 LHDs, we actually had, I think it was almost 800 people come and see the performance.
Wow.
And of those, we had 485 who actually filled out a 3-page survey, which we were quite impressed by.
Yeah. Getting anyone to do a survey is a struggle.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, we had significant engagement with people wanting to actually get involved. And I suppose it was kind of quite interesting to see from the survey the number of people that, so the very fact that people filled out the survey was probably one outcome in itself, and they filled it out in quite a bit of detail. There was a lot of honesty and information about why they come to work, what their stressors are. We also, I suppose, got a lot of insight into who people feel safe talking to in the hospital. And they talked a lot about talking to their peers, but not really talking to administration. One of the key things about the workshops was we asked people to develop solutions. So we actually have a 3-page Word document which has approximately 80 recommendations for things that people can change in the workplace. Some of them are very specific and some are quite complex. So there was a really lovely one, which was that one of the few things in hospital that we realize is most people in the hospital system don't see happy outcomes.
Mm.
So we might stop someone from dying, or we might, you know, be able to keep somebody going. But that really positive environment, which, you know, is quite rare in health, is something that is present in the ONG department, so when babies are born.
True.
And so one of the really specific ideas that came up, which I thought was so lovely, is whether there could be like a little bell chime or some kind of sound that every time a baby is born in the hospital, that sound rings through the hospital and every staff member knows what that is. So they can kind of hear it and think somebody, a baby has been born in our hospital today.
Mm. Yeah, and I've heard stories of that too, where they play a song every time a baby's born, and that's really well received by staff.
That's right. So, you know, some really simple things like that come through, which through to very sort of complex things. Some people really were encouraging mentoring programs. There were some very specific ideas around what kinds of training could be implemented. And then there were other things like having a walking track in the hospital, which would allow staff to take a break, go for walks, but also then be able to interact with each other in those environments as well.
Right. So it sounds like there's a lot of common themes around trying to improve the overall, well, not just the culture, but the overall, I guess, mood of the community.
Yeah, and I think that's probably where people misunderstand what culture means. So you know, the culture of an environment is not something you can create. The culture of an environment is something that exists as a result of a combination of the systems, the people, and the impacts. And so the idea that, you know, a lot of these different changes that were being offered and across those different themes I mentioned, so physical environments, you know, behaviors that may be considered inappropriate, like bullying or sexual harassment, leadership models and how people lead teams and how empowered people feel and whether they're recognized for their positive outcomes, you know, all the way through to systems. So things like, you know, the internet systems and the training and support that is provided for people to work within those systems. Each of those themes actually add up to the culture because the culture only exists with all of those components. You actually can't say, oh, we made the culture brilliant even though the environment looks really crappy. The culture isn't brilliant, you know, even though all of those components have to be considered. You may not be able to change all of them, but they all need to be acknowledged for a culture to be positive.
So my understanding is Grace Under Pressure, a big component of it was focusing on the pressure of perfectionism and the impact that can have on mental health of people working within the area of health. Why was mental health such a core component, or why do you think it was such an important core component of this program?
Well, I think mental health is kind of the outcomes of the culture that we work in. And I think mental health, by definition, people often try to associate mental health with mental illness. Mental health is actually how is our mental and emotional status right now. That is your mental health. So the idea that mental health is not a core component of any part of anything that we intervene in people's lives to try to improve would be quite unrealistic. Sport has a mental health outcome. Going to work has a mental health outcome. The culture that you're in has a mental health outcome. Seeing a play has a mental health outcome. So I think there's probably a misunderstanding some people have that mental health is like a separate topic that you can focus on now or not focus on now. In my mind, the reality is everything we do should focus on mental health, because actually whatever we, however we behave and whatever we learn and however the world interacts with us becomes part of our mental health or lack thereof. And I think when we think of it that way, it makes a lot more sense, because if Grace Under Pressure was about what is the environment that you work in, you know, physical, people, systems, sense of value, all of those things are the culture and the environment you work in. That is what Grace Under Pressure is about. By default, the only reason we're asking those questions is because we care about how you feel about that. If we didn't care about people's mental health, number one, then we wouldn't ask those questions. The flip side would be, if we're going to ask those questions, it has to be in relation to how it makes you feel. What is your mental health as a result of those things? Because that's why we would change them. That's why we want to improve them. So I think by default, that is the case. I mean, more specifically, part of the timing of Grace Under Pressure came out after there were a couple of years there where a number of junior trainee doctors were having significant mental illness, and there were a couple of suicides that were very public. Comes off the back of a lot of the bullying and harassment, I suppose, media that has come out in the last 5 to 10 years. And as a result of that, there's been a lot of attempts for individual organizations to start to change their approach to various components of their programs. Everything from mental health support through to training around appropriate behaviors, through to remediation and discipline against people that would behave inappropriately, through to looking at how they approach their programs and trying to reduce the stress and workload. So a part of what Grace Under Pressure was to acknowledge the stressors that we all have seen in the health sector. And this is over the last, you know, 20 to 30 years. We're not talking about in the last 1 year only. This has obviously been an ongoing problem. But also to acknowledge the changes that have occurred as a result of the increasing awareness, the fact that most LHDs, colleges, and, you know, regulatory bodies have all said this is not right. And so everybody has been trying to implement components into their organizations to improve these stressors, to get rid of them, to make them less painful where possible.
But those changes obviously take time and the impact of those things take time, and sometimes they don't work. So there was a part of Grace Under Pressure timing-wise that was about acknowledging all of those things that had been done, seeing where it had worked, and also saying, you know what, sometimes it hasn't. And maybe part of the process of Grace Under Pressure was also then the third part to go, let's see what has worked and celebrate that, but let's also now look for new solutions at a time when we have been able to implement some things and see if we can come up with other ideas for areas that haven't improved.
So mental health sounds like it's one of your, and particularly mental health and medicine sounds like it's one of your passions. Why is it so important to you?
So, I mean, I think mental health is incredibly important to me because I think it's actually the core of how human beings enjoy life. So I suppose that's a very general response. I think mental health really matters to me in terms of my work and my career, because everything that I do in all my different careers actually work towards improving people's mental health, because it's either in learning, it's in communicating and relating to people better, it's in performance and therefore entertainment and art and creativity and helping people to explore the world in a different way, or it's in consulting work where my job is to help people to think about things in a different form and actually help and enable them to achieve their outcomes that they want to, which therefore allows them to feel empowered and autonomous and successful and therefore improve other people's lives, which is all part of the Maslow's hierarchy, which says the idea that everything that we do in life is about feeling satisfied with who we are. And that is what I would call mental health. So all my jobs obviously also play to encouraging mental health. And then at a more personal level, I have as a child been surrounded by mental illness in sort of various components of my family, as well as not necessarily illness, but inappropriate behaviors. And that over the time of my childhood and into my adulthood has progressed and made me who I am. It has taught me various mechanisms of dealing with my life, and obviously also has impacted upon my ability to engage in the world and my mental health. And so I have obviously had my own journey in mental health, and that is something that I feel I'm particularly skilled perhaps at being able to be honest about that journey, to have learnt from that journey, and to see the value of engaging in mental health and mental illness. And therefore, I feel that I have a responsibility to stay in that space where other people may not want to be, to stay in that space where maybe I can make a difference, and to stay in that space because I think that that is the core space of how people grow and thrive in the world today.
And now a quick word from the M2.0 team.
Hey everyone. So to commemorate the convention that never was, Mel 2.0 is dropping exclusive merch on Sunday, August 2nd. We have a limited number of patches and t-shirts, so get in quick when sales open. We're also acknowledging AMSA's most seasoned veterans with coveted medals of honour based on the sticker book and eSports Day participation. For more information, head to the AMSA National Convention Facebook page.
Thanks, Meg. We'll get back to the episode.
Would you mind sharing with us your journey through mental health?
I suppose we would start with the fact that, and this is obviously going to sound very psychotherapist-ish, but, you know, all of our senses of self, they start in our childhood and they start very, very early on. So when you ask me about my mental health or my mental illness journey, it begins when I was basically born. And you know, there are a few key things that happened in my childhood that I'm very conscious have impacted upon how I approach the world. So things like attachment, my parental figures. My parents got divorced when I was pretty much just over a year old. And they, you know, my mother actually left me and my dad together. So my mother was the one who moved away, so which is very unusual, especially in those days. It was very uncommon for a mother to leave the child. So I was with my father. You know, he had a lot of difficulty working out how to play both roles. Again, that may be cultural. It may also be generational because at the time, you know, the father was the father and the mother was the mother. It was much less, I suppose, blurred or overlapping in terms of what a man and a woman did as parental figures. So I found myself having to grow up quite early on in the piece in some ways. As part of that, both parents developed new relationships and moved on to other partners. My mother has actually been married 3 times officially.
Oh, wow.
And is presently single and living in Australia. and I support her now, but I have therefore seen, you know, multiple marriages and relationships. Mm. You know, my father remarried and had a son to his new partner. And so I also lived in a household where I was now the daughter, you know, the stepdaughter, so to speak, and they had a separate child. So there was a lot of stuff that went on in my childhood, and without going into detail about my parents' experiences, because they are still alive and I want to be very respectful of
that.
It was a very complex childhood.
Yeah.
It was a childhood where my identity, my role in the family, what I had to be responsible for definitely didn't equate to any books that sort of represent how children normally are. Mm-hmm. You know, I was definitely a combination of all of those books that talk about the most difficult childhood kind of version of the world. Mm. And so my growing up became very much, I suppose, a choice I made. And I have thought about this a lot, because when I got to med school and I did my elective, I actually went to the UK for my elective along with a number of my friends.
Mm.
And I worked in pediatrics and psychiatry. And when I was on my psych term, I met this girl, and she was basically around about my age. You know, she was very intelligent, seemingly attractive, and, you know, very, what I would have thought if you'd seen her on the street, very, very normal.
Mm.
There was nothing about her that indicated that she wasn't capable of being functioning in social life.
Mm.
But she was a patient in the hospital, and I got to know her quite well while I was there. And turns out she'd been hospitalized on and off for probably close to about 6 years by then. So she'd been starting to go as a teenager and had kept coming back to the hospital many, many times.
Wow.
And what was really interesting in getting to know her and her story was her childhood was very similar to mine. So a number of traumas and, I suppose, abuses, you could call them, in her childhood would mirror my story quite well.
Mm.
And she had ended up becoming an institutionalized patient. That is where she was at. And there was me on the other side of the world doing my elective and about to become a doctor.
Mm.
And I think what it made me realize at the time was you choose different ways to approach life. And there are choice points in the way that you consciously and subconsciously evolve that really do impact upon what happens next. And I'm not saying that it's a case of I chose the right thing and she didn't, because a lot of it is not even a conscious thing. But I look back on my childhood, and first of all, I am who I am because of my parents and because of my childhood and because of all the other things, friends, issues with socializing, racism, those sorts of things. All of those things that happened to me when I was a child have created the person I am today. So I don't regret any of that.
Mm.
But I also am very conscious of the fact that over time I've come to understand that my way of dealing with a difficult world was to presume it wasn't someone else's fault, to optimistically assume that nobody was trying to hurt me. And therefore, if there was something wrong, it was my problem, and therefore I could fix it.
Mm.
So I suppose that's that's a short version of a number of years of psychotherapy. But what it meant was, is I was very good at seeming to be resilient to bad things happening, because I never believed that the world was bad in that sense.
Mm.
The flip side is I took responsibility for everything. Everything was something that was my problem that I could fix. I happened to be very good at fixing shit. So it turned out mostly to be okay, because, you know, I was a very functional person. But the load on me as a human and the inability for me to see that what someone else might be doing could just be bad, and I probably didn't need to have to put up with it, meant that I found myself in many situations where actually I was accepting behavior that was wrong.
Mm.
I was diminishing my sense of self and I guess what I felt I deserved to try to subconsciously to try to be okay with the behavior and presume that if I just changed something in me, then this wouldn't be a problem.
Mm.
So over 20 odd years of that, it does start to wear you down, and you do start to reach a point. And in my life, I have been very lucky to be blessed with a number of very, very close friends. I would say I have a large social circle. My parents are all still alive, and that includes my step-parents and my ex-step-parents. And I've maintained really strong relationships with all of them. So I have a lot of people in my life. And as you get older, I hate to say it, it's true, the older you get, the more shit happens. And so, you know, when you're a child and you've got three things to deal with, like I got, you know, bullied this morning because someone called me a chink. And then the guy that I really like at school kind of ignored me. And then I got my test result back and I got a 94% instead of a 98%, which, you know, in hindsight sounds quite trivial. But at the time was like the end of my life. You know, I got to a point when, as an adult, where I was in abusive relationships, I was dealing with alcoholism, not myself, but through my partner. And, you know, I was also working in an environment, as we know, in the hospitals where people were dying, where the emotional and mental stress of doing a good job is significantly high. And my family still had ongoing sort of mental issues. So I had high demands from parents, which were quite unrealistic necessarily. And in amongst all of that, you know, you then also have to deal with the adult things of life, like buying a house and paying a mortgage and not knowing if you have enough money, as well as having to deal with kind of more unusual things like people around me dying. And that was the trigger in the end that led to me reaching a point where I actually couldn't keep going and I attempted suicide. So I suppose that's that journey that leads to that point, not going into too much detail, but I got to a point where, so I was probably, I can't remember how many years I was out of uni. My mother had left her third husband and moved back to Sydney and I was now supporting her. So I was basically my mum was my dependent, which is obviously also a really flipped model of the world and is not something that you naturally would kind of expect. I'd moved away from full-time medicine, so I was part-time medicine and also pursuing acting and my consulting work, but everything was very up in the air. So my job was very inconsistent. I had a partner who I was very close to, but his family and his lifestyle didn't really match with me. They were quite affluent and, you know, they enjoyed a really lovely life. It didn't make sense to my brain and I was trying to fit in because I was still in that mode of it must be me. And that relationship was going quite poorly. We actually had separated and we were in the process of working out if we could get back together when he actually got diagnosed with acute myeloid leukemia. And over the period of a week, they tried chemotherapy. It failed because his liver failed and he died. And that death process was unfortunately really terrible for me because his own family was dealing with their emotional grief and they didn't have space for me. I had to disallow myself to feel like I had a right to be part of his death. And that meant that I spent almost no time with him in those last weeks or so. I wasn't really allowed to be at the hospital with the family, you know, and sit with them and kind of process that grief. So because we had broken up, his family, I think, saw me as part of the problem. And what that meant was that they didn't really include me in that last period and I wasn't able to have any grief myself. What it meant was I had two choices. I could have got really angry at them because of the way they were discounting me. I mean, their logic was, you know, they broke up and she upset him and now he's dying and I totally get that. But I could have got angry and that probably would have helped me to experience some of my grief, you know, to feel like I had a valid right to be upset about his death. And and why wasn't I given the opportunity to sit with him by the bedside or to do any of those things, knowing that in my head we were actually seeing if we could get back together. So we had a real relationship. But being me and having learned all of my mechanisms that I had, you know, in my childhood, my way of dealing with the issues was to say, they have every right to feel like this. I was able to understand where they were coming from. And I basically had to, in my own head, go, well, this is not their problem. This is my problem. I need to be okay with this. They're the parents. They have the right to do this. And that meant that I basically subsumed my identity and my existence in that process. So I didn't matter. That's how my processing put me in the room. It's that I and my feelings and my relationship to him didn't matter. So that's obviously not a great place to be when you're dealing with grieving over a partner who you've had that you thought you were going to marry at one point. And so when he did die, and in the aftermath of that, it was quite a difficult process. His family didn't really engage me a lot. And again, to be respectful, I don't want to go into the details, but that process was actually quite traumatic for me too. And my friends who were around and very supportive didn't really know him. And so again, I didn't get to to grieve with the people that were also grieving for him.
Yeah.
So I was very isolated. I was taking all the responsibility. I was undermining my own right to have these feelings and to be considered important in his life. And in the aftermath of that, I then had a miscarriage.
Oh, wow.
So I did not realize I had been pregnant with his baby, but I was. And so having had the miscarriage, obviously I was dealing with, you know, not just the grief of losing my ex-partner, the way that his family and I suppose his family had behaved and my way of dealing with that, but then also the fact that my friends who were trying to be supportive couldn't really engage in my grief process. Then on top of that, I had the miscarriage. And the thing about the miscarriage is therefore I'm dealing with all of the hormones that come with pregnancy. So my body, my environment that was mentally and emotionally dealing with all the other stuff, my physical environment was also then suddenly, well, probably not suddenly because it was already going through it and I was not aware, was being impacted by all of these hormones and chemicals. And having to see, so essentially I and I can say this to a medical group, you know, I passed a products of conception, so, you know, POC, and had a bleed. That at that time was so traumatic to even visually watch. I started to have significant emotional impacts on myself as part of that process. I actually tried to share that with a couple of people in an attempt to maybe reconnect to my ex-partner's social circle, and essentially they initially accused me of lying.
Wow.
And kind of shut me down. So the environment I was in by that point, the way my life was moving forward off the back of my childhood and the way that I had been brought up and my mechanisms to deal with trauma, I was in a terrible place at that point. Now, interestingly, and this, you know, kind of brings it back to something I often say to health professionals. So the unfortunate thing for all of us is we have signed on to a job that is essentially going to always reflect some part of our daily life. So when we look after our patients, when we, you know, go into the hospital system, the reality is that someone we know is probably going to be going through some kind of illness. That may be a friend or a family member. Worst case scenario, it's a parent or your child or yourself or your partner. But the likelihood of walking into the workplace after you're having difficult times with the health of people around you and having to deal with something similar is unfortunately very high. So the potential personal triggers are huge. I took 2 weeks off work after that happened, and then I finally decided to go back to the hospital. And I went back to the hospital, and one of the patients I saw on one of my first ED shifts where I had kind of flagged, look, I think I need some support, had a miscarriage. And so I was faced with processing that. And unfortunately, it wasn't like she was having the miscarriage at its core level was not the reason she was in hospital, but she had had a miscarriage. And so again, you know, inadvertently, the health sector has kind of confronted me with this situation that I'm trying to ignore and distract myself from by going back to work. And I went home that day and basically just kind of reached a point where I couldn't see a light. I couldn't see how being in this situation was worthwhile. Now, to be clear, and I can say this quite, I suppose, calmly, because I've spent a lot of years processing my experiences from when I was a child and since that point. And I must admit that I guess I have a very ambivalent view towards life and death. I've never been someone who was goal-driven. I've never been someone who had, like, you know, the list of 10 things to do in my life. I've never defined myself by my jobs or my careers. And so there's always been this sense in me, and it probably relates to my childhood and to the ways that I approach the world and the assumption that, you know, everyone else is probably very happy and it's just I need to fix myself to be accepted in the world. I also didn't see that if I die tomorrow, I'm not going to regret. I'm not going to be like, oh my God, I didn't do this or I didn't do that. Because the flip side of being me was I was always very open to things. I always took chances. I always, you know, tried really hard. And so I had a very strong sense in myself that I was comfortable with what I had done with my life until now. So there was no real sense of, you know, I can't die because I need to do something else. There was no real sense of missing out.
Okay.
And the flip side is in my life, I also had a mental sense that everyone else is okay And so whether I'm here or not is not actually going to be the end of the world for anybody else. In fact, the people that I would have been most relevant to, i.e. my ex-partner and my child, were dead. And so there wasn't anybody in the world that I was essential to be there for. And it sounds very cognitive. It sounds very intellectual the way that I process that. And it came from a very emotional place. But when both your, and this is that mental health question, emotionally I was in a terrible place. Mentally I was able to make sense of that terrible place and make the decision that logically it didn't matter actually whether I was here or not. And so if I think that everything's really crappy right now and I don't think I need to hang around, then why wouldn't I go? So that was kind of the logic that got me there. You know, this is full disclosure. So I had actually written myself a script for some beta blockers.
Wow.
Now, like you could easily argue, and you know, some have said, was that why you did it? To sort of manage anxiety, to keep yourself calmer. And that would be a relatively logical treatment option for dealing with anxiety. A lot of people use beta blockers. But I also have been diagnosed with Wenke back. So I have a heart block.
Right.
And so the reason I'd actually purchased the beta blockers was because I knew that if I took enough of them, my heart would probably stop. I didn't take those medications for an extended period of time after I took the prescription to the chemist and filled the prescription. But eventually, at that point, after that shift, after everything I'd been going through, I reached a point where I decided to take that medication and overdosed on beta blockers, went to hospital. The only reason I went to hospital, to be honest, was a friend of mine, a medical friend, just accidentally, who happened to be working nearby, called me. It was the timing, you know, and timing is everything. But he happened to call me. I happened to be a little bit out of it and he got very concerned. And because I probably wasn't as conscious, I told him the truth and he sent an ambulance to the hospital.
Oh, wow.
Interestingly, in the meantime, another friend of mine contacted me and realized what had happened and she took me to hospital. So the ambulance arrived and I wasn't there because I'd already gone to hospital.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, and in hindsight, what that shows me is that there are people that really do care. And that was a really interesting thing to have to process later. But I ended up in hospital, was kept on the ward for a period. Afterwards, when I went home, I must admit that gave me a real insight into the mental health sector and what support services are available and the limitations of that. And the flip side as well is in the aftermath of that, I also had to come to terms with what I'd done. And I was reported to ARPA as part of my admission.
Wow.
And if I can say nothing else, and if nobody gets anything else out of this session, the one thing I would really want you to keep in the podcast would be to say that my experience of being reported to ARPA was about ensuring that I had a structure that supported me in my decision-making and took some responsibility off me and put it back into the hands of objective people that are looking at the greater good to work out whether I would be safe to continue to be a doctor. Now, at no point were they disrespectful. At no point did I feel judged more than I was judging myself. And in fact, it actually takes away some of that sense of pressure that many of us type A personalities take on. It's not my job at this point in time when I am dealing with other things to know if I'm capable of being a doctor or not.
It's
actually my job to be able to put my hand up and say, I can at least diagnose that I have trouble right now really kind of differentiating. And so maybe I can still be a doctor. Maybe I'm still going to be okay to do that. But I'm probably not the person who can make that decision.
Yeah, right.
And that was what being reported to ARPA, and I actually don't love the phrase. I think it's a really terrible phrase to use, but it's what people know.
It's got negative connotations.
Was actually incredibly helpful. I actually had an assessment through them. And when they said to me, we're happy for you to continue to work. And at no point during the assessments was I ever stopped from working. I chose not to work because I didn't feel comfortable. But when they were able to reassure me that they felt through their assessments and through what they've understood that actually, you know what, from being a doctor perspective, we think you're okay with that. It's up to you now to decide how you feel personally. But that was incredibly reassuring.
Absolutely.
And I think that's the mistake we make is – I use this at the start of a lot of my talks, but I mean, every man is an island, 100%, but every island is connected to a mainland somewhere under the water. And the idea that we're ever individuals who have no impact and no response to the world around us is absolutely untrue, but it can feel like that. So finding ways to reconnect yourself to the mainland, to connect yourself to the other bodies of land that are around you, actually makes you a bigger landmass. It makes you stronger. It makes you have more foundation. It makes you more stable. And so I think that's one of the key things that I feel very, very confident about, is when I say, if you need help and if APRA becomes involved, so if the regulatory body that has the resources to assess and support you and keep you and patients safe, that is an opportunity. It is not a threat.
There's just so much fear around mandatory reporting, and there's so many barriers to taking that initial step towards recognizing when you need help and if you do actually seeking that help, because there's that huge fear of being deemed incompetent, and it's this seen as this the reporting is this very negative concept.
Yeah. I mean, the most practical way I can respond to that is to say, we don't even have enough doctors now to fulfill all the roles that are in Australia. So do you really think that the body that is trying to manage the health system and support its professionals would take you out of the system unless they really felt that you were a risk either to yourself or to your patients? If you are a risk to yourself or to your patients, do you really want to be working as a doctor? So in fact, by that logic, there is no reason not to engage in the processes of being assessed and supported by someone like APRA or, you know, your college or the people in your hospital who are administrative, who have the opportunity to have an objective view of what you're doing.
Wow.
So after all of that, having got through that, and small little side note is I actually had moved out of my home due to issues with my family. And so I was actually house sitting at the time. So I ended up jumping from home to home and house sitting for a year after that, which was a very weird experience, being essentially homeless. But for the following years, I had 5 deaths in the 5 years of people under the age of 40 who were very close to me. In amongst that, one of them was a man who I was essentially his person responsible, even though he had family in the US who had disowned him. And so I ended up having to deal with his estate. I had another friend who died overseas in a freak motorbike accident. And there was a lot of different things that had gone on. I was investigated by the police because one of the other people who died was an old friend from school who was now a drug dealer who I had a very unusual relationship with, and they thought maybe I was dealing him the prescription drugs. And in amongst all of that, my mum accidentally burnt my house down.
Oh my God.
Went through the process of rehousing her and the other person living in my house, and I had to rebuild my house again.
Oh my gosh.
So, you know, that's my life. That's the kind of life I have. And, you know, it's gone on since then, but I won't go into the more recent stuff. But the key being, I suppose, that little story is one that indicates when I say that I've had troubles and traumas, I definitely am not exaggerating. But, you know, if you want to believe, you can come through them, and there are ways to approach your life to not just survive but thrive. I'm probably a very good example of that.
Yeah, and gone on to do work in the sector to encourage open discussions around it and that positive culture change to help support each other.
You mentioned earlier that you've spent a period of time in psychotherapy. Do you have any thoughts around seeking therapy?
Yeah, I do. I must admit, I think it's a bit of a voodoo topic. I think it's something a lot of people don't acknowledge. I would argue that therapy is so important, but maybe the word therapy is not the right word. I think the idea of having a support person, an emotional support person, like you would have, you know, a mentor or registrar on the ward, or the way that you'd have a coach in sport, which is where that sort of phrasing around like coaching and sort of those sorts of things have become really popular, like your life coach idea. But I think there's a real value. I've really, I suppose for me, I mean, so I'm in therapy and have been on and off for a very, very long time. And most importantly, since my partner died and I had the miscarriage in the aftermath of that and the suicide attempt, I started seeing somebody, and I've been seeing them now for over 8 years. And considering my crazy schedule and how busy I am and that we do not have a regular time to meet, I've still managed to see her almost every week. That's a really huge commitment on both of our parts. And I think that's what partly is really useful there. I think the key things that come out of it that I really, I guess, want to share is that therapy is actually not always going to be about kind of being told what to do. And I think a lot of people worry about that. But the flip side is also therapy is also not just somebody listening and nodding. And it's a really nice balance in between where you get to have an intelligent conversation or an emotional conversation with somebody who has lots of skills and is very interested but is not affected by your life, which is actually incredibly important because you can never be completely honest with somebody who is affected by what you're talking about. So one of the great opportunities there is the fact that there's kind of this space in a room with somebody who actually has no investment in your life other than to be there to listen to you talk and to try to help you process that. So I think when you frame it like that, it makes a lot more sense to people. I think I was speaking to a really dear friend of mine and a colleague. She's a psychotherapist, and I was asking her thoughts, and we kind of were chatting through it. And some of the key things that I think came out of it were that, you know, the reason why you do therapy is so you get to have more awareness and space to understand yourself. Because if you do that, you actually have more choices than anyone else. Because people that don't know themselves and don't know what they need actually don't have as many intelligent choices to make. I think as well that it's important to know that with your therapist, if you do get one, actually it's not about the person that you like or the person who's like you. What you're looking for is someone that you trust. And depending on who you are, and to be honest, if you're a doctor, trust a lot of time comes from feeling like they're an expert, feeling like, you know, they have something to offer you. But often in times as well, it's about feeling like maybe they are separate enough from you. So often people go in looking for themselves in the therapist. And sometimes it's really good to go in and find somebody who comes from a different perspective, because actually they have more to offer you in that sense. I think one of the other things that is really something that I've kind of come to realize is that people sort of talk about the fact that, oh, you know, if you're in therapy, you must be crazy. And I kind of flip it and go, if you're in therapy, you're probably the sanest person I know. Being in therapy is not a sign, you know, that there's something wrong with you. It's actually there's something right with you because you've gone to therapy. Every single human being can benefit from spending time talking to another human being about themselves. When you say it that way, it's a simple fact that if you can spend more time exploring yourself, you will probably be a better person. So in fact, the sanest and most normal people are probably the people that actually do go to therapy and process stuff and don't actually hold it all inside, never think about it, so it all blows up one day.
I've got insight.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's like saying that if you had issues on the ward and somebody died, you just pretend it didn't happen. It's like, you know, there's no, that doesn't make sense. So, you know, and part of doing trials, part of doing evidence-based medicine, part of research is all about analyzing the data you have. And so actually therapy is just kind of like research into yourself.
Yeah.
So if you want to have an evidence-based approach to yourself, then you kind of need to spend the time doing that. And I suppose the other big one I would throw in is that many people, as I said at the start, you know, they go in thinking that the therapist will tell them what to do and they might not like that. The flip side is also if you're looking for someone to solve your problems, the therapist is also not going to do that. And I think that's a mistake people make. They go in and they do like two or three sessions and they think, oh, yeah, that's enough, you know, or I got nothing out of it. And I think that's a mistake in the framing. So I suppose I kind of think those are really important things to bring up and to say out loud because, you know, everyone should have somebody they can talk to about themselves who doesn't have a vested interest. If you're really lucky, you have that in a friend, but does that friend have the skills and also the space to support you enough? And the flip side is if you're investing in other things, if you're paying for a personal trainer, if you're paying for your gourmet food to be delivered, if you're paying to watch a play because you enjoy entertainment, the idea of not paying for somebody to give you the space to get to know yourself, research yourself, and improve yourself in that way seems like a silly thing to not do.
Yeah, absolutely. You talked about how your friends played an integral part and people that were close to you in helping you seek support afterwards. Do you think that if someone had reached out and asked you the question directly of do you have a plan to kill yourself beforehand, would that have started the intervention process earlier at all?
You know, I think that's a very interesting question. And I think it is one that doesn't have an answer. I sort of term it very similar to the question, if you got pregnant, would you have an abortion?
Mm.
I think the theory of that is something you can have a very strong opinion about, but in the moment it's very hard to know.
Mm.
I definitely had friends who were around and who were very concerned for me. I had had a previous suicide attempt before, which not that many people knew about, but those that did were very conscious of it.
Mm.
But I think the interesting thing to keep in mind is the intervention that had occurred to that point. It wasn't like none of my friends were caring for me. It wasn't like people weren't showing me that the world could be a better place or supporting me through the process. And in another time and place, in a different year with a different partner, with a different, you know, partner's family, I may or may not have responded the same way to his death.
Mm.
And if I hadn't had the patient who came in who'd had the miscarriage, you know, there are so many factors involved in where I got to that the idea that one person asking me that question earlier would have stopped me is hard to answer.
Mm.
The flip side is, did it take me that long to even think about it because my friends were so engaged and so supportive and so involved? The answer is probably yes. So their ongoing just being there in the space with me, and some of them did a terrible job of it, I'll be honest with you. There were people who were trying to support me who were doing and saying all the things I didn't want to hear. But even in their failure to choose the right response for me, you know, which is, mind you, only for me because someone else might have wanted exactly what they were saying.
Yeah,
I still knew they were there. And I think that's something that a lot of people have to realize is they try not to get involved unless they can help and fix it. And I kind of go, you can't actually help and fix the mental illness or the problem, but you can help this person feel less alone.
Absolutely.
So that's probably the one thing that they did do.
Along that thought process, do you have any recommendations that junior doctors and medical students can do to continue to support their peers and contribute to that positive culture change around mental health?
I think it's an interesting dynamic. How do you support your peers and yourself? I think the first thing I would say is learn how to get to know yourself better, because the more honest you can be about your own feelings, your needs, your sense of identity and what impacts on those things, the more conscious you will be of when they change and what's changing them, because that gives you the ability to step in and adjust those things. And the reason I put that first is whether you're helping yourself or trying to help someone else, those things about yourself, your feelings, your triggers, how comfortable you are in the situation will impact your ability to do both. And I sort of keep using that one analogy of that sort of drowning versus treading water versus swimming, or, you know, failing or succumbing versus surviving versus thriving as kind of this sort of three-part model. If you can't swim, then you can't save someone else from drowning. You know, that's kind of the important part. So no matter who you're trying to help, the first thing and the strongest and most important thing you can do, and you have to be really brave to do it, I won't lie, is get to know yourself better. Spend time understanding yourself and why you do what you do and who you are and where it comes from and what triggers you and how you deal with it. And it's not about judging yourself. It's not saying that whatever you find out about yourself is not bad. It's just who you are. But the ability then to evolve yourself, not to change yourself, and I really hate the word, you know, change.
Yeah.
The ability to evolve yourself is only possible if you already know what's there. You know, you can't evolve from nothing. So that conscious of evolution, that ability to consciously improve yourself, you know, if you want to use that term, has to come from having an understanding up front. And again, if you want to help others, you have to know yourself before you start doing that, because going in blindly thinking you're okay and they're not is not helpful. Going in blindly and not knowing when they trigger you into becoming either defensive, aggressive, judgmental, or lecturing, if you don't know when those things are happening, then you can't see the impact of your behavior on them, and you also don't take responsibility for your behavior. So that's like one of the key things I would say. More generally, which I think is where you were asking me. So more generally, some tips about how to think about creating a positive mental health culture in your environment, whether that be you, your colleagues, your workplace, your home life. I think number one is it's okay to not be okay. So the question of are you okay, I actually don't love that question, I must admit, because the gut response to any normal functioning human who doesn't want to impinge upon another person is to go, yeah, I'm fine, right? That's what we do. The question should not be, are you okay? For me, the question is always, how are you? Because that allows it to be very neutral. You're not pre-framing kind of a question. So that's the first thing is it is a how are you?
Absolutely.
Where are you at?
Which comes very much back to our training too, with our open questions before we go for a didactic kind of yes, no response.
Exactly. You know, and I think that's probably a really simple frame to think about. The second thing I would say is don't say something you don't mean when it comes to mental health. Placation and, you know, trying to make someone feel better, or even saying I'm sorry or I feel really bad for you, I would just hold off saying that unless you mean it. Because when people are emotional and highly sensitized, they will pick up on anything inauthentic very quickly. If you think about the last time you were very emotional or you were maybe having a fight, you pick up on other people's emotions and truth very quickly. And therefore, what might have just been discomfort on your part or uncertainty can be turned into, oh, they don't mean that to the other person. And you lose a lot of your relational skill, your trust, and even any impact from what you said. So I would be really quick to say, don't jump in and try to talk through the solution or talk through your caring.
Yeah.
Be there and care with your body first. And then when you know what you want to say and you can say, I truly mean this. So if you can preface anything you're about to say out loud for someone who is in a bad place with, I truly mean this, and then say it, that's what you should be saying, because that will come from a very meaningful place. So that would be tip two. The third tip I would have is a lot of people like to use the argument, oh, you know, when I see someone else going through a bad time, I'm sure they wouldn't want me to ask because it'll embarrass them. My logic is the person you're worried about embarrassing is yourself. And the person you're trying to protect is yourself. And absolutely, they might be embarrassed and they might tell you to fuck off. They may tell you that they don't need your help. But the first thing that you've just done is you've shown them that you can see something's wrong. So if they're lying to themselves, they have to work out what to do about that. The second thing you've done is you've shown that you care. So whether they need your care, they suddenly realize somebody gives a crap. The third thing that you have done is open the conversation. And basically what that means, and I would say this, I think this, you guys would hopefully learn this in your history taking. When you ask a question, often you need to ask it kind of three or four times before you get the real answer. You know, like sometimes when someone, you say, so do you have any pain? Oh, not really. And then you watch them and you go, I think you've got pain. You ask them again and you're more specific, and then they start to talk about the pain. And by the third time, maybe you've got a proper history. You know, and often, you know, what the patient tells the nurse is different to what you get told, and what the patient tells the registrar is absolutely different to what you get told. So there's a reality here of what we say the first time is usually not what we mean. And so I would always encourage people, if you see someone and you're thinking that they might need something, and you may not even be the answer, let's be clear, but you have a responsibility to engage. And that can be engaging and saying, look, I don't want to be inappropriate, but I just want to acknowledge that you seem upset, through to, can I help you? How are things going? I'm really worried about you. Anything on that spectrum, to even just nothing related to what's going on, but just going up and going, hey, how are you doing? Because actually putting yourself in someone's space might give them that opening. And then if they do decide to ignore or rebuff or, you know, push you away, if you give a crap, you need to go back. You need to try again. So first of all, you need to know who you are. You need to be safe in yourself to be able to go in there and work with that other person. The second thing then is to ask the right kinds of questions. Don't ask questions that put people in a situation where they're responsible for suddenly making it clear that they're having a terrible time. Because that puts the onus on them. And it's really hard to bring up the fact you feel like crap. You know, then once you've done that and you've asked the right question, it's about kind of letting them decide how they respond to it, but knowing that your question has had a value, and then coming back and trying again.
Absolutely.
And the only person that looks bad in that, if you do all of that and they keep saying, please, please go away. Yeah. The only person who looks bad in that is essentially no one.
Mm.
Right? Because you've tried and you've tried for the right reasons. So don't try to save the world, but you would know that you were trying to save the world if you've worked out how you really are first. So if you've done the first step, you would know if you're just trying to save the world and you probably shouldn't do that. But by the time you get there, if you say something and you really mean it and you've worked out who you are first, nobody looks bad.
Mm.
If the end of that conversation is, I don't need your help, I'm okay, nobody looks bad.
Mm.
And that's what people don't understand. They go, oh, they'll be embarrassed. Oh, it's too inappropriate. It's like there's nothing inappropriate about caring. Mm. There is something inappropriate about deciding that somehow some social construct is more important than caring.
Mm.
But the other flip side of it is it's okay to care and to have them not need you. That's the other part you really have to be all right with.
Mm.
You know, it's not up to you to decide if they need you.
Mm. Yeah, all you can do is offer.
But you do need to commit.
Mm.
So that would be my main tips, yeah. I think, at that level.
Yeah, no, you've provided some incredible insight today and I really appreciate how open and honest you've been. It's been amazing. I'm wary of time, so I'm just going to ask you this last question, which is, our would-have-been convention had the theme of new perspectives.
Mm-hmm.
What does new perspectives mean to you, and is there a particular perspective you try to live your daily life by?
New perspectives, what does that mean to me? I think, I suppose in my world, so, you know, in all the jobs that I have, new perspectives is kind of my life, really. It's being able to take something that's in front of you and reframe it. So that will probably be the way that I use the term. It's seeing things through a different lens. It's being able to understand and explore something and get to know it better, because as soon as you know it better, it's not the same.
Mm.
So all of those things are probably what new perspectives mean to me, and that's what I do for a living. So I love the theme. I think it's great.
Mm, thank you.
I think the important thing to remember about new perspectives is new perspectives don't take away what you already know.
Mm.
Sometimes people feel that in finding a new perspective, you have to discount everything before that, and that's absolutely not true. And I think that knowing that can help people to be more comfortable with taking on a new perspective.
Mm.
In terms of my life, so many, many years ago, and this is, you know, probably one of the positive outcomes of my childhood, was I wrote a signature on my email, which I've kept since I was a teenager. And it says, live for perfect moments. They exist in every second you forget to enjoy. So my perspective is that if you pause for a second, every single moment that you live is exactly the perfect moment it should be. Doesn't mean it's happy, doesn't mean it's fun, doesn't mean it makes you smile, doesn't mean it makes you rich, doesn't make you feel better all the time. But if you can presume that everything that is happening in your life every second of every day is perfect because it's actually exactly what should be happening, and it is going to help you be the person that you are going to be. It allows you to approach the world slightly differently. It allows you to see beautiful things and see wonderful moments in what may seem to be a really sad time. It forces you to be more aware of the world around you. And I think the other thing it does is, if every moment is perfect, then you should be able to get something out of it.
Mm.
So I believe in the idea that everything is a learning opportunity. Everything is a chance to know more about the world around you.
Mm.
And I suppose that means, that's probably why, as I said at the start of that, I guess everything's a new perspective.
Absolutely.
Because every second of the day you're growing and you're changing, and now you have a new potential perspective. And it's up to you whether you allow that lens or that frame to come out or not. You can hold on to your old perspective. But in fact, even holding on to your old perspective takes more effort.
Mm.
And so you do have a new perspective. So I think that's how I approach the world.
Mm. Well, thank you again so much for your time today. Before we finish up, is there anything that you'd like to plug or encourage our listeners to reach out to or engage in?
I don't know where I would start. I would plug, but I haven't been working on it much recently, which might give me a reason to work on it more. I do have this site called Nay in the Life, and the premise of that was to kind of take themes that happen in our daily lives and explore them from different perspectives, just to help people to start to realize that, you know, the world is complex, and the way that we use words and language and the way that we interpret experiences actually can be very different depending on which frame you put on it. And that's something that I was working with some young upcoming artists with, and that it was a really exciting project. And I think I got a lot of positive feedback from the honesty of the program and some of the entertainment that came around it.
Mm.
So that is something that maybe if people started going back to it, I'd like have to go back and work on it more, which would be great. And I think the only other thing I would say is, you know, I would plug the idea that I would recommend that you spend a little bit of time getting to know the most important person in your life, and that is you.
Mm.
And if you can commit to doing that, then I feel like I would be richer for it, because in some ways you're investing in the social community around us and therefore that impacts upon me. So, you know, I will make a lot of riches from you spending a bit of time getting to know yourself.
Mm, very insightful. I can't believe you had such an insightful perspective as a teenager that you put in your email. That's incredible. I definitely don't think I was that insightful as a teenager. I think I was too busy listening to emo music and cutting my own fringe.
Well, if you can cut your own fringe, that's a good start.
Oh, it was not a good choice. Well, thank you again so much for all of your time, Jane.
No, you're very welcome.
Well, that was a bit strange. Might have to keep an eye out to see what that Morse code means. Thanks for listening to today's episode of the Answer Ampule Podcast 2.0 series. Our code work this week is Lap of the Map, which if you go to our website, www.m2020.com.au, and insert the code word into our portal, you'll go on the running to win some great prizes and giveaways, as well as the opportunity to complete our sticker book. The M2.0 series is a subset of AMPUL, the Australian Medical Association's ongoing podcast series to highlight the speakers who would have been presented at our 2020 ANSA National Convention in Melbourne. If you'd like to learn more about our podcast, you can visit our website www.m2020.com.au or our parent website www.amsa.org.au. Or if you prefer, we're on social media as AMSA National Convention on Facebook and Instagram. For more information on the topics covered in this podcast, you can reach out to AMSA special interest groups such as AMSA Mental Health on Facebook, Instagram, and the AMSA website. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the speakers and do not definitively represent those of AMSA or their subsidiaries. If you would like to know more about our public policies, please visit our website www.amsa.org.au and select Advocacy followed by Official Policies. This episode of AMPUL was hosted and edited by Alyssa Biziani, with special guest Dr. Renee Lim, with music by James Palmier and credit music by Nick Barrett.